should have had to achieve, but those things do happen sometimes, but our apology on that score. Would want to take this opportunity myself and my co-chairperson, Mr. Stoner, to welcome everybody and thank you very much for responding as you did in terms of coming to listen to the presentation by the Auditor General. And in welcoming you, just to indicate to you that this idea of a parliamentary hearing or presentation came from a meeting that the Auditor General had with our Speaker of Parliament and the Chairperson of the National Council of Provinces, as he was introducing himself soon after his appointment, and then in that meeting they then discussed that annually, probably, rather than just presenting to one portfolio committee, which is the Scope Assigning Committee, they could do what you called a stakeholders meeting in provinces, nationally, and also in municipalities, certain municipalities, so that everyone who matters within those particular institutions could then be brought together, and then a summary that focuses on strategic elements of the report is presented for your own understanding. And then later then the SCOPA will then have to deal with the details and of the report and interrogate it or scrutinize it in the manner in which they usually do. We hope therefore that this exercise will also enhance your understanding on the principle governing the Auditor General, their mandate, and also how, as legislators in particular, can we use the auditor's report as a tool for oversight. And I think this exercise really is more to give you this tool, make it user-friendly, and for you to understand it so that when you are in your committees, if there are sections in the report that obviously relate to your area of oversight in your own specific committee, you could then pick them up and then engage on those particular issues. As you know, that oversight is both the overseer of the financial aspects, but also their policy assessments in terms of whether these policies are taking us where we ought to go, but at the very same time, whether in the service delivery and the projects indeed are happening, and then there's a better life that is being created in our own country. So please accept this presentation, therefore, as a tool that has been given to you for your own understanding, and it will enhance you as chairpersons of committees. Auditor General, here we have an assembly of chairpersons from the select committees in the NCOP, and also chairpersons from the portfolio committees in the National Assembly. We also have amongst us those who are whips of those particular committees. And then we also have party representatives, because some parties may not have a whip allocated to a particular portfolio committee, but we have party representatives also. I think all the parties that are part of the multi-party represented in Parliament, they are also here. We also have presiding officers that are present. I see House Chairpersons from the NA and the NCOP, Ms. Mildred Oliphant, House Chairperson for Committees in the NCOP, and Mr. Jeff Deutsch, House Chairperson, House Chairperson for Committees in the National Assembly. Whatever work then that arises from this exercise and SCOPA, they will be following up on the issues that need to be followed up by the committees themselves in scheduling of and approving meetings and ensuring that indeed we do our oversight work. We also have officials from the committee section, because the committee section has to support the committees when they check up on issues. So we felt therefore that some of them should be present here so that they could also understand the task at hand. We also have researchers or the research unit also, which is represented so that they could also begin to look at areas of research that they need to take on board in assisting the committees to do their oversight. And myself here, I'm Robert Mabela, House Chairperson for Oversight and International Relations, but today's focus is oversight aspects of things. And then Mr. Tsietse Setona, who is the co-chairperson of the very same task team, that is identifying mechanisms that Parliament could then begin to improve on or utilize if there are new mechanisms that we think we ought to take on board in exercising oversight as the Constitution has mandated us. As you will know, that for the past 10 years, the Parliament was more focused on the overhaul of the laws, apartheid laws, into making them align to the new democratic dispensation. So we are now in that era where Parliament is shaping its way of overseeing the executive in action or any organ of state. But then those mechanisms are not provided for in the Constitution. The Constitution only says Parliament at its own time will develop its own mechanism. So we are almost on the final stages of finalizing on that. So currently, myself and Mr. Sona are co-chair of that particular task team. And then soon after we are done with it, then the presiding officers will decide who then takes it forward. But the committee sessions that you have chairperson are already involved in some, because committees are the primary drivers of the oversight based on their line functions. And when there will be institutional mechanisms from time to time where the institutions, collectively the two houses, might identify an area and say, this is where we want Parliament to focus on. And from time to time, institutional mechanisms on oversight that throws everybody will be identified within the program itself. Those are my welcomes. Mr. Sona will then do the purpose of the meeting, and I'll hand over to him, and then thereafter introduce the Auditor General and invite him.
Thank you very much, Chairperson Mabela. Honourable members, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure we are all agree that over the past period, there's gradually emerged a consensus, political consensus amongst us, across party political lines, about the imperative for Parliament to position itself appropriately in terms of executing its constitutional mandate on oversight. And part of that consensus, is actually compounded by soul-searching discussions and engagements at various levels in committees and in various forums, in terms of how do we use the existing critical instruments that are available before us to ensure that Parliament adequately performs this critical mandate of oversight. And there's no disagreement, I'm quite certain in my mind, that the Auditor General's report is not the scope and board, but it can actually serve as a very, very critical instrument for any committee within Parliament in terms of its own oversight mandate. Example, is a situation where, for instance, certain issues are raised in the audit report of the Auditor General. But you find that only the Standing Committee on Public Accounts is seized with that particular report deliberating on it. Now, the issue again arises in the next year. And this issue has got a key implications to delivery and transformation. You know? In some of the departments, for instance, if you look, you may find that this year they are saying we have had this amount of money that we have not spent because of problems around recruitment. No, in the next year, the same number might have reduced, come lower or go higher. We're not even able to relate as to whether this number that is appearing here, which appeared last year, is it a continuation of the number that appeared the previous year or what? So we think it's important that we must begin to position our committees, to deal with those aspects, so that while the Standing Committee on the public accounts deals, with financial aspects of this, then committees that are relevant are able to be seized with the performance aspects of the report. So in the main chapter, the Auditor General is here to preserve its overall findings on the audit outcomes and trends for national and provincial governments for the period 2006 and 2007 financial year. It is indeed a high-level overview of the findings for both houses to take note of. And I'm quite certain that we are all aware that the Auditor General has consciously embarked on a roadshow program where we have been meeting in the recent weeks with provincial legislature in the same kind of exercises that we are assembled here now to entertain today. And in a final analysis, Chairperson, the goal of the presentation will be to elevate the key issues before us, you know, as a chairperson, as a committee, so that we are able to go back in our respective committees and say, how are we integrating these issues within our overall oversight program as various committees. And the intention will also, Chairperson, to create some sense of appreciation of what challenges are we having in various departments in terms of, you know, spending. I think it will be one of the critical aspects for this presentation. So without any waste of time, Chairperson, I want to join you in thanking our chairpersons. I know most of them have cancelled whatever engagements they've had, you know, to honor this kind of important meeting. So without any waste of time, I'll give over back to you. Thanks.
Thank you very much. At this point, I would like to invite the Auditor General, Mr. Terence Nombembe, I hope I've pronounced the name correctly, to the podium. And he will then, in turn, introduce his team and the colleagues, accompanied here by Mr. Kimi Makwedu, who is the Deputy Auditor General. And then, but he will then introduce the rest of the ESCO members or himself, and then also, if you want more about himself, you'll also say who he is besides the name, and also besides the title of being an Auditor General. Auditor General, I then hand over to you to introduce your team and then start with the presentation. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much, Chair. To the joint chair that presiding over this, this gathering, thanks very much for the opportunity you gave us, and to the honorable members that have made the time to be with us here today. I thank you indeed for giving us an opportunity to share some thoughts with yourselves and dialogue on the issues that we believe have been analyzed in a simplistic manner in order to achieve a purpose that is admirable for our government. And that purpose being, I want to say this up front, is to have unqualified audit reports. I think that's the only reason we're here today, to work towards unqualified audit reports. So if you don't hear anything that I'm going to say today, as long as you remember that I'm here to say how do we get unqualified audit reports, full stop. The presentation that we have today is very informal indeed, because it's meant to help us to engage in the dialogue towards the goal of unqualified audit reports. We will be putting together a formal report, which we call the General Report, during the course of November, which will consolidate the information that you see in this live presentation and attachment, which report can be now a handy report that can be used continuously throughout the year by the various committees, including the Public Accounts Committee throughout the country, to work towards this particular goal. And the way we've structured the information before yourselves, just for ease of understanding and discussion, it is structured in three parts. We have combined the provincial and the national information so that we can, because of the joint sitting of two houses, be able to see a picture for the whole country and for the two spheres of government, that is national and provincial. And it's classified into three main areas. The first area is the audit opinion that is given for each department. This is a very important section, because this is a section that basically gives the final conclusion on the results of the audit process that takes place over 2 to 3 months of auditing by ourselves. And then the next section to that would point then to the areas that have given rise to the conclusions that we've arrived at. And then the last section is a section where we analyze the underlying drivers of what we have picked up. And this is where I think that the bulk of the debate and discussion needs to be focused on. So how do we then take these root causes, understand them clearly, so that we can then allocate our respective responsibilities, both as auditors and as the oversight body of government, to move towards unqualified audit reports. So that's basically the structure of the presentation. It's meant to be that simplistic because I believe it is a simplistic analysis of the issue. Before I start flashing the slides which we've got in front of you, I just want to point out and reflect on the question that I was asked in the October session at the beginning of the year. I think let's say it was January or February when I appeared in front of SOPA. When we presented the results of the national department, which were then sitting at 12% unqualified, the question was twofold. What is the picture in other countries? And how long is it going to take us to get to the IBM? And my response to that question was, I don't know, I'll go back and find out and come back and reflect on that answer. And in today's session, I can confidently say that we've done some work in the countries that most members in this house have actually visited, which are the countries that are already applying accrual accounting as a basis of their accounting practice. And we've identified that in those countries, the audits on average, because of smaller countries, on average are including provinces and public entities between 40 and 50 audits. But of that average number of audits that are audited, less than 3 ever receive qualified audit reports. If you translate that to percentages, it's single digits. There's only single digit audits that are qualified. When you look at the UK in particular, we realize that they had that trend. However, last year, that number shot up to 13%. We couldn't understand why it has actually shot up to 13% in the UK. But we think that the UK, having recently introduced the International Federation of Accountants newest standard, which is IFRS, which is the most stringent method of accounting in the UK, that may have been the reason why there's a spike in the UK, but it's a spike only to the extent of 13%. So that's the answer to the question that was difficult and asked early this year. But we went further and asked ourselves, what is it then that gives rise to this picture? And we realize that the only reason that this picture is actually like this, and I'm sketching the screen so that you can understand that we're here to actually identify what is it that is going to take us towards unqualified audit support. And because I don't want that theme to be missed in this discussion. We realize that there are about 5 or 6 things that they do in those countries that have put them in that situation, which things are not impossible for us to actually adopt in our jurisdiction as well. The discipline that exists within the government department is such that on a monthly basis, there are accounts and financial information that is presented for review. to make sure that the quality and timeliness of accounts is not compromised. They've introduced monthly reporting in their government. They've also introduced a discipline where before the accounts are handed over to the auditors, someone checks that those accounts are accurate. Someone confirms that the information that is contained in the financial statements agrees with the schedule or schedules that will support those numbers, so that when the auditors come, they can actually spend very little time finding information. They make sure that where documentation needs to be made available, there's a clear trail of the access to those documents. So that's the area of financial discipline that has been introduced in this country. I am aware of the fact that in our situation we may not necessarily have monthly financial reporting, which is something that National Treasury is working towards. But certainly, we ought to be having a discipline where before the accounts are sent to auditors for auditing, someone must check whether those accounts are correct. At the minimum, that's at least we should be able to do. On the other hand, one of the things that has resulted in most qualifications in our report has been a situation where explanation of information that is critical to avoid a qualification is not provided on time because of the availability or lack thereof of key officials during the audit process. And what the countries do, they make it their business to avail key officials, head of department accounting officers, during the audit process, so that any audit-related matter can be dealt with and cleared timelessly. That does go a long way in avoiding qualification. Because in our situation, we do find a case where some of the qualifications are driven by the fact that information is not necessarily not available, but information is just not made, presented to us, but it's somewhere there. Or the context, we're not talking here about a situation where the context is not clear, but someone who could actually present that context was just not available to present it, hence the qualification. So the availability of officials during the audit is actually very, very critical discipline that is instituted in those jurisdictions. A more important aspect of success in this situation is the strength and effectiveness of internal auditors and audit committees, who has got the primary responsibility of championing the design of a sound control environment and monitor compliance statutes. I'm highlighting these things to demonstrate the simplicity with which this goal can be achieved and what others do to often sustain such records. So the effectiveness of internal auditors and audit committees is one of the issues that is of critical success. And lastly, the role of the leadership. And in the leadership here, I would like to echo the introductory remarks that were cited by both the chairs sitting next to me about the role of the leadership from this house, which is and the legislators and the provinces as well, on the oversight side. What leadership is there to make sure that there is effective monitoring of the performance of the department, insofar as, I'm going to bias here towards financial management. To what extent do we have financial management signals in the monitoring of the performance of the department? Of the department. So that when information comes to the portfolio committee, those questions around financial management practices are actually asked. And I'm talking about the questions of, do you have sound financial statements that are presented regularly or checked before they supply to the auditors? Do you have internal audit committees? Do you have audit committees at all? Do you avail yourself during the course of the audit as the head of the department? So those kind of simple questions. That's what we talk about here. Let's talk about complicated questions about finance. But you need to have sufficient enough information that will actually facilitate the asking of those simple questions. Now, do the committees here actually have that question, those practices? Because that's what other countries actually have as a norm. What the leadership obviously on the executive side has got to do, they've got to do the same. And the questions asked by the legislature and the questions asked by the executive ought not be different, because they are all complementary and they should all work towards a common goal. But what also is critical, which is applicable once again to both pendulum of leadership, is the issue of the skills available to actually produce accounts in government. Because when you talk about accounting matters and moving from cash to accrual, we talk about accounting understanding. Now, we should be asking questions, do we actually have people that understand accounting in the manner that is prescribed by National Treasury? Because to the extent that there's a shortage of those such a skill, we will continue to have modifications in our report that may not be necessary. But as simple there, because there's a misunderstanding of the accounting treatment of the thing that Treasury wants to be treated. And therefore, the appointment of those accountants is a responsibility, one that leaders in this country have actually taken seriously and confirmed that it is honored. And we have some ongoing monitoring as a tone that becomes their role. Now, what is unique about South Africa is the fact that we're still in the path that those countries have been, which has taken them 10 to 15 years to actually get to full accrual. We are midway through our PFMA introduction. I think we're in the 7th or 8th year of PFMA now, and 2 years or 3 years of MFMA. But when it comes to the introduction of GRAP accounting or accrual accounting or migration towards that, we're still having a few years. I think it's about 3 or 4 years since we have introduced that discipline from a set of perspective. Now, and what those countries have done, which has been quite effective, was to actually plan for that migration. Plan is such that they actually understand what the requirements are going to be to get the government ready to actually cope with these requirements. But not only plan, but also support guidance and provide support to make sure that the people that have got to account for these matters are not only ready to account, but they actually have the competencies to account because they've got the guidance. So about my long introduction, let me highlight the importance of what others have done, which is simple, and what others are continuing to do, which is simple, which is actually yielding the right results. So that when we start looking at our situation, we don't consider ourselves actually in an impossible platform to be able to accomplish this issue. Because it's simple thing that we need to do in order to achieve great results. Okay. Now, with that introduction, coaches and the honorable members, I want to now take you through our own results. Which would be flashed, and I think it's in the first page of your handout. Insofar as the national departments are concerned, we have excluded Home Affairs here because that report is still in the process of being finalized with management. And by the time we conclude the formal general report, those results will be available and that department is also being incorporated. So with the exclusion of Home Affairs, let me highlight that we have got the results that look like this. And these results can be categorized in four main categories mainly. And I'm going to go through this a little bit slowly so that you can understand what each category means. There are top two categories here which make reference to adverse opinion or disclaimer of opinion. These are the categories which are, I would regard as undesirable. Because all they simply mean, the adverse is that the accounts that you see in front of you are fundamentally unreliable. Because from the audit perspective, the information or the records that have produced those accounts have got the results and information that differs from our own answers as auditors. I hope that makes sense. So in this case, we actually have got evidence, we did our own calculations, we did our own analysis, and arrived at a situation that differs from what has been shown in the account of the department. But the extent to which it has happened so fundamentally that a number of accounts or the highest volume of those amounts differs from the way in which we have arrived at an answer. Hence, we say we disagree with the accuracy of this account. Highly undesirable conclusion. Disclaimer basically means that we're sitting here with accounts for which we actually did not get any information or evidence to support what is contained therein. Also highly undesirable. So in the national department, we're sitting with a situation where there's no department that is sitting in that category. So that we have to wait for Home Affairs and finalize the situation when Home Affairs is in. What exists though in the department is a situation where we've got 11 or 33 or 10 of the accounts that are actually qualified. Which means that it's, in those accounts, the bulk of the aspects thereof we're happy with, but there are aspects of those accounts that we're not happy with. But the situation is not so pervasive that we can actually disclaim the opinion or issue a total disagreement with the whole set of accounts. So for those departments that are qualified financially. But we've got another set of classification that is also important. Financially, those accounts are satisfactory because departments either had no significant errors or departments that had errors have actually taken the time to adjust for those errors. And therefore, financially saying we're happy, but there are other matters that we've raised there, which in the past years were classified under the emphasis of matters. There are matters that we've raised there which require attention of the leadership and attention of the oversight and attention of the department to resolve in order to actually eliminate the concern by the auditors. So in this case, we've got about 60% of the departments that only have that. But over and above that, there are departments that actually have got the qualifications in other matters. And we only have about 9% of three departments that have neither the financial concerns nor the other matters of seriousness that warranted to be included in the audit report. So that's how we classified our conclusion. Now, in terms of the details of which departments are affected by these, the last two pages of your pack, of your handout, will actually show the department and analysis. So while I'm talking, we can basically look at which departments are qualified and what. That's the picture insofar as the national departments are concerned. And it doesn't look too different from the previous year, with the exception that we seem to affect Home Affairs in that picture. You can roll forward one more slide. Insofar as the provinces are concerned, the reference was actually just for your notation so that after the meeting you know how to read this information and which reports you need to be interested in order for you to get more details. Now, in so far as provinces are concerned, we've got a slightly different picture, which is saying that we've basically audited more than 100 votes in all the 9 provinces. And the reason this year we've analyzed very few, a slightly fewer number is because in the Mpopo we are still busy wrapping up those audits. So we only have 3 votes that have been concluded in the Mpopo. There may be one or two in other provinces, but the majority are sitting in the province. But by the time we finalize the general report, we will have all that information for Limpopo as well. But the picture is likely not to change significantly from what we have. Yeah, I'm not going to go through explaining what a disclaimer is. I'm just going to contextualize the results. Here you can see that we've got 7 departments that are sitting either in an adverse or disclaimer of opinion, which is half of what was the situation last year where we had 14 departments sitting in that category. So some improvement there, although highly undesirable because we ought not to be having departments in that category at all. We've got 46 or 43% of the departments, which is equal to the other 42%, that are sitting in either qualification or other methods. So there's an equal split between departments that are financially qualified in provinces and departments that are not financially qualified but other methods that we've got. And we've got a doubling slightly of the departments that are unqualified from 5 to 10 this year in the provinces. Now, once again, the details of which departments fall into these categories by province, you should have another attachment that will be handy for you, which looks more or less, I think it's a 3-page slide, yes, that looks like this. It's going to help you with the analysis of these classifications by province. But let me just highlight perhaps the go back to that one. Let me just highlight the ones that are unqualified, the 10 that are unqualified. We've got 1 in Gauteng, 2 in KwaZulu-Natal, 1 in Mpumalanga, 3 in the Northwest and Western Cape, respectively. So that's the classification of the unqualified opinions in the provinces. And the with regard to those that are qualified, that's your next page. I think the numbers are self-evident, but I'm just going to focus on the ones that have got disclaimers. The percentages are actually very important here because if you look at the, let me start from right to left. If you look at the Western Cape, we've got 3 departments that have qualified, which constitute 19% of the population vote. And it goes on like that for all of them. But the ones where we've got those 7 disclaimers are sitting in the Northern Cape, we've got 2 departments that have got disclaimers there of the 8 departments. In KwaZulu-Natal, of the 6 departments that are qualified, we've got 1 that is got a disclaimer. And the balance of 4 are residing in the Eastern Cape, we've got 3 adverse and 1 disclaimer. So that makes up the adverse and disclaimers that you see in the picture. So that's the broad analysis in so far as the provinces are concerned. But you can see that when it comes to other matters, there's a lot of departments that are affected by other matters. Here, if you can just discount in proper because only 3 reports have been finished. Once we've got the full set, that number is going to change significantly. So the point I want to make is that other matters are highly prevalent in most of the departments, nationally and provincially. And if there's an area that we need to pay attention to, is in that area of control environment. Okay, the next slide now goes into what are the areas that are driving the conclusions. Here, once again, I've combined the provincial and the national picture, where the national picture is shown in bold, and the provincial picture is shown in the red, in the line that is cutting across. And that line is a representation of the proportion of prevalence per department of the issues that we've raised qualifications on. Now, the best way to read this information is to start with the yellow picture or the light shaded picture in your handout. where on the income statement, because the yellow side is representing the income statement section. On the income statement, we've got very few departments, less than 30%, and 27% in the provinces, sorry, in the national. But we still struggle to get evidence relating to expenditure. This is now talking about monies that have actually been paid out of the bank accounts of the department for projects that are meant for service delivery. In 27% of the departments, and I guess just around 30% of the provinces, we could not get evidence of support and expenditure. But in 70% of all government departments, we were able to get the evidence to support that expenditure. And that's the way to read this. I'm highlighting that one because if one looks at the manner in which we used to focus, the areas rather in which we used to focus on as auditors, our audit focus used to be purely on expenditure because of the cash accounting nature of our framework. And whatever qualification may have been there in the past would have actually been focusing on the extent to which we could get evidence for expenditure. Nowadays, only around 30% of the departments that are giving us that feature. So if we were to ring-fence that area, you'd be saying 70% of the departments would have been unqualified today. Am I making sense? Right, but we've since moved on. We've now introduced modified cash accounting. And with modified cash accounting, National Treasury has described other requirements that need to be disclosed in the financial statement. And those requirements have required that all material losses that include expenditure, irregular expenditure, should be disclosed. And therefore, and revenue must be disclosed in a particular manner. This is supposed to be disclosed in a particular manner insofar as the income statement is concerned. And only about that proportion, I mean 27% or even less of the department were not able to actually give us information, evidence supporting those disclosures in their financial statements. Once again, a low proportion of departments that have got modifications insofar as these areas are concerned. And as part of that requirement, the Treasury has even introduced information that needs to now be disclosed in the balance sheet of the department. In other words, a statement of financial position, what the government possesses and what the government owes. Okay. Which never used to be there before. And then if you look at the blue section, there again, around 30% of the departments or less had troubles in providing evidence of the information related to the balance sheet items or liabilities or assets that they needed to have accounted for. And if you were to exclude capital assets, which is the only area where all the departments that were qualified in national had an issue on, and about 92% of the departments in the provinces that had an issue on, we will be sitting with a situation where around 30% of the departments in provinces and national would have been qualified. I'm happy on this so that we understand clearly what is driving this qualification, so that we don't generalize about it. And therefore, if we then work on assets, which is where most of the departments have got a problem with, we'll be sitting with a situation where the reverse in terms of the proportion of qualification to unqualified opinions would have been different today. Now, the reason in the provinces, of course, that less than 100% of the qualified departments is that I think Gauteng had a program, and in fact, Gauteng is the only province that did not have qualifications on assets. simply because they had a structured program there that they had introduced midway through the year, where Provincial Treasury took charge of that program. Provincial Treasury gave guidance in terms of how they were going to implement the National Treasury requirements of assets. They had clearly defined milestones, and every department had to report on how they're doing against those milestones. That's the reason, and that's why that was the only province that did not have qualifications on assets. And where there are errors in departments, they actually were able to often process any material errors as far as assets are concerned. So this slide is basically saying, fix assets, fix the balance sheet, and disclose the items, and all the accounting-related requirements, then we should be okay as far as qualifications are concerned. But the only concern that we need to earmark here is the fact that we still have departments, the tune of 30%, that still cannot provide evidence for the money that they take out of their bank accounts and pay someone for services. I think that is a serious area of concern. So I hope this slide then makes sense in that concern. Now, move on to the next one. Then we have other matters that were raised. And on these other matters, we have also split them into three areas. The internal control environment, which is shaded in blue there, or in the handout, the light gray. Instances where there was non-compliance with legislation, and instances where governance was not adequate. And as far as internal control is concerned, we also zoomed in into the specific areas which we believe needed attention. And it's not too many areas. It's only areas in so far as the information systems or computer audit controls are sufficient, where about 60% of the department's national had control witnesses on their computer systems controls. The reason the number for provinces is low is because our coverage of that in the provinces was not as extensive as it was in the national, but we will be looking into increasing that coverage into the future, because all departments are basically responsible for using computer systems. But the other context to this is that most of these systems are actually managed nationally, so the bulk of the systems would have been audited at the national level. So those are the two reasons why the number, insofar as provinces are concerned, is lower in terms of the coverage. But the more important area is these adjustments that are done at the last hour when the auditors are there. About half of the departments had material adjustments that were made during the audit. And we're saying that we need to avoid a situation where these adjustments are done during the audit. And we need to find out what these rights to get. If you remember the regular financial management review, we go a long way in eliminating this situation. And we also had a special focus area that we looked at in most of the departments, which was the human resource management plan. To what extent have departments implemented their human resource management strategies, and 30% of the departments national and just around 50% provincially had not actually had their human resource management plans approved. Most of them were draft, but some of them, even though they were there, they were not complied with. So those are the situations that we actually picked up. Over and above, just other few areas that we focus on, which are isolated to specific departments like health in terms of the DORA or condition grants requirements. But the bulk of the coverage was on human resource management. You would appreciate the reason for doing this relates to the fact that human resource management is critical to actually capacitating government to do its carry out its mandate. And that's why you identify that as a focus area in all departments. So that's the picture that is coming out in terms of the formalization of those plans and the implementation thereof. Now, the compliance to legislation is mainly linked to legislation that is associated with financial management, primarily which is CFMA or Treasury Regulation compliance. But more importantly, on governance, we're talking here about issues that have got to do with the effectiveness of audit committees and internal auditors. That's primarily what we talk about here. there are a few instances where we picked up the lack of implementation of the public accounts committee recommendations, which we also factored in there, but it was only in a few instances. And in other instances, it's a few of the coordination of the responsibilities between two agents. So there were those, but the bulk of that 50% also relates to internal audit and audit committee effectiveness. Which I do think is important. As a starting point, if we are to clear all the issues that we've spoken about up to now, we do need effective audit committees, we do need effective internal auditors. Because if we get that right, it will then be the primary catalyst for dealing with most of the internal control environment and issues that we are facing today. Right, so that's the statistics in so far as we are about to analyze them, and the reason we did this, once again, is so that we don't actually generalize about what is driving these qualifications, but to paint a very clear picture, and a simplistic picture that these qualifications are actually informed by very clearly defined areas of accrual accounting or migration towards vesting, as well as the guidance that is required in order to actually make people to cope with the slowly growing stringent requirements of accrual accounting, because this is very elementary phase of accrual accounting, and therefore we need to arrest this problem while it is needed at this instance. And I think the practices from other nations are very clearly defined for us to learn from and adopt as part of this house and the experience. Now, insofar as, if you go to the next slide, this has been an analysis of where we picked up the issues, and that this would be basically a repetition of what I've already said, but just to round things up. For all those balance sheet items, for all those income statement items, for all those internal control and legislative compliance and governance issues, what we're picking up as a common trend is that the control environment in most instances is structurally defective, and it requires to be sorted out. And this is where internal auditors come in very handy. This is where all the committees come in very handy. In some instances, if we go to the next column, there's clearly defined guidelines, but compliance thereto seems to be lacking. Once again, internal audit reviews, as well as audit committee monitoring. By highlighting those two centralized units, I'm not saying that management should not be doing these issues. What I'm saying, management is expected to comply with these issues, but from a supportive point of view, we need to have then an independent reviewer of these compliance and control environment methods. There are issues of readiness, certainly in terms of the understanding and interpretation of accounting skills. This is where the treasury comes in very handy, whether provincially or nationally. To strengthen the manner by which these accounting treatments need to be considered, and also strengthen the interpretation thereof, and also strengthen the support, guidance, and training on these accounting methods. Over and above that, this is where the leadership comes in to say, do we have the right people to then respond to treasury requirements to be able to cope with these accounting requirements? So this is where I think the skilling issue has got to be considered, both from the executive side as well as the, I would say, legislative side. Portfolio committees, for instance, when you consider budgets for departments, do we make sure that we provide sufficient resources to have the right skills? I suppose we do. But to then monitor whether or not people employ the right people to get the job done. Once again, I'm biased towards accounting capacity here. But it's a question that should be asked, not in a generic sense, but in a specific sense. Because we need good accountants, and I'm not saying chartered accountants here, I'm saying good accountants, people that understand accounting in order to be able to cope with accounting requirements. And then lastly, the tone that we need to set from a leadership perspective on both sides of the coin. Do we have the right questions to ask? Do we ask those questions in the first instance? And this is where I would like to, with the presence of the chair of portfolio committees here, perhaps that's where we need to be looking at the coordination between the public accounts committees and the other portfolio committees to say, while the public accounts committees are looking at these things annually after the event, to what extent will portfolio committees ask these questions continuously throughout the year? So that by the time scope has considered these letters, all the solutions are readily made available and volunteered to scope us. And that coordination can then work effectively. As a fact, the same questions need to be asked by the executive authorities and the HODs on the aspect. Chair, I would certainly on this point agree with you wholeheartedly to say the issues that need to be considered to minimize these qualifications are not necessarily accounting issues. They are operational issues. And therefore, we need to ask those operational questions in order to deal with the accounting complexity or the impact on the accounting results. I would like to then on that note, Joint Chair, thank you for the opportunity given us. The last document is what I went through in my introduction, and it's a clear reflection of how other countries have actually accomplished these things, and they've not done anything difficult, they've done something plain and simplistic to achieve, I mean, excellent results. So, and thanks to the members of this important house for giving us the opportunity to share some thoughts with yourselves. But I would also like to then extend a word of thanks to the people that put together this information that appears so simplistic. But the work that has gone into actually putting it together has actually been quite enormous. And I guess under the leadership of the Deputy AG, Stephen Makwetu, maybe he needs to stand up because they don't know who you are. To say thank you for mastering the process of coordinating this information in such a straightforward and simplistic manner. And definitely the team that actually was marshalling the field workers that were actually auditing out there, they're not all here, I think only three of them are here. Cynthia Gwende, who's the head of auditing in one of the sectors in our business, Cynthia can stand up and remain standing. And Lady Zondo, next to him, who's also the head of another portfolio of auditing. So stand up, ma'am, and remain standing. And Kamesh Bana, who is another head of another audit portfolio. The other person not here, Wally Van Heden, and these are the four people that actually are finally responsible for auditing in that business. And these are the people that basically the backstop with them when it comes to auditing matters. These are the people that signed all the reports that actually were actually issued out and have got the responsibility to make sure that those reports have got credibility. Thank you very much for your good work. And then Lindela Jababu, who is the head of our corporate body support unit, can just stand up now. Under our guidance, this information would actually have been coordinated through multiple disciplines within the office, starting from HR, going right through to the reporting unit, the parliamentary unit that has been working here on this information, which, and the list is endless. People that have made the work of the office, easy to actually compile information of this nature. And so that's what I should highlight these corporate executives, because that's the top layer when it comes to the leadership of this organization, which the Deputy Auditor General is working with together with myself to make things happen in that institution. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, AG, on behalf of the honorable members. Just to highlight three issues before we could go into some discussions or clarifying questions, just to provide a context. Honourable members, I'm sure will agree that there are three issues arising from this presentation. One, we deal with the questions of clarification arising from the presentation. When doing that, mindful of the fact that there's still a substantive process that is going to unfold, yeah? At the level of SCOPA and at the level of various portfolio and select committees. So when we engage, we must actually be mindful of that, so that much as we want to engage here now, we must know that we still have an opportunity in a more focused and pointed way in our various committees, you know, to engage quite substantively. I'll now, on the basis of that, you know, having highlighted that particular point, open the floor for questions of clarity. And I will go in this order. Honorable Chohan Kota on this side. Advocate Mike Masuta, Honorable Hogan. For now, it's that three. And there's a hand there still on the chair. That's all for now, yes. In that order.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the very detailed presentation, which I think is eye-opening for most of us. The one issue that I do want to ask about is, to what extent does this kind of presentation actually happen? It's happening here at the level of Parliament, but does it actually take place at the level of the executive, so that there is a global sense of how national departments and provincial departments are performing, perhaps a kind of a report card being given to premiers and to the presidency and so on, because I'm sure that that would be enormously useful on an ongoing basis. And the second, probably more of a comment and perhaps even a request, is it's quite interesting, although we don't have the comparative study that you alluded to in your introduction, obviously that gives us some background and some sense of a framework in terms of which we assess ourselves. But it's quite curious that you then indicate that Britain, for example, being a very well-established democracy, hundreds and hundreds of years old, you introduce a new system and then suddenly there's a glitch. Whereas with us, those introductory elements have been almost on an ongoing basis in the last few years. And my question would be whether, firstly, we could have a look at that study or a synopsis of that study. Secondly, whether, in fact, democracies in transition have been a special focus as opposed to, you know, well-established bureaucracies and administrations, and whether you found any like comparable in that regard.
Advocate Masuta.
No, thank you, Chairperson. I'd also like to echo the sentiment of my colleagues before me that it is indeed an eye-opener, except to say that for those of us who are visually impaired, the small print has not assisted that much in following the input, and perhaps if we could have it in electronic form forwarded, as we have provided our email addresses, it might just bring us at par with everybody else. But I just wanted to say that, two questions. First of all, the issue of annual reports and the interplay between that and the annual audit reports. I think it would help somebody like me to be able to use this tool to assess the annual reports that have just been tabled in Parliament, to see whether I can pick up the rating or the responses to the rating of my department in the content of their annual report. In other words, what is the linkage between the two, and how can my committee be able to draw from the annual report the context and to what extent the department is attempted to address some of these issues in the scope of their work. The second and last question relates to what some Treasury officials sometimes refer to as the fiscal federalism. It is a particular reality to those line functions, mainly in the social services area like health, education, and in our case social development, where the bulk of the services provided under even national legislation and policy is actually provided at provincial level. And it doesn't seem as if there is a relationship in terms of oversight and accountability, a direct relationship between the national sphere and the provincial sphere. So it becomes a bit tricky for us to claim that we're doing oversight for the purpose of assessing whether services are actually being delivered without being able to go directly into the province as a national parliament, especially the National Assembly, a portfolio committee, and assess for ourselves on the ground what the situation is. So in other words, you find that you're looking at the national department, but essentially all you're looking at is auditing or holding them accountable for their coordinating function, but not actual implementation. So there's very little, actually, to look at if one confines oneself to the actual programs that the national departments, as opposed to the provincial departments, are delivering. I wonder if you have any comment on that.
Thanks, Advocate Masuta. Honorable Hogan.
Chair, my issue is the legislature. That we have no case in which the information on the audits of legislatures, both at national level and provincial level, is tabled. I know that there is still, and I am extremely distraught, that there is still not, and at the national level, a Financial Management Act which places the legislatures under that discipline. But notwithstanding that, I do think it's part of our responsibility here. We need to understand and have an overview of what is happening at legislatures at all levels. At all levels, and I'd like to recommend that in future, when we do have a presentation looking at what's happening in the executive, and this is probably more focused on Mr. Bapela than yourself, I'd like to hear Mr. Bapela's view, that we should actually have an overview of what is happening at provincial and national legislatures.
Thanks. I'll allow the... Oh, is there another hand? Maybe a mistake is around in that way. I noted Kev, yes, then it is followed by Honorable Kassinyane. There was another area. Can I do this, please, ma'am? I've just got a conferral by the AG. I'll take Phil on the before. He says he'll be more comfortable to take the questions in the time. I'll just compromise. I'm taking Phil, and then I'll come to the second round. Okay, Phil.
Thank you very much, Chair. And thanks indeed to the AG and his team for a very comprehensive presentation. AG, you are saying that qualifications, more often than not, are not as a result of accounting problems, but operational problems in departments. Now, taking that further, I would like to know whether, to the extent that a number of departments receive qualified reports, is there an opportunity four departments to share their experiences so that these operational problems that you are referring to can then be shared and for them to obviate possible difficulties, whether it relates to the non-functioning of audit committees or whatever other, say, operational problems that may be in existence. We, I think, 1.5 months ago or so, received a report from the Public Service Commission with regard to financial misconduct in particular, and it worried us that a number of cases reported there of financial misconduct in financial terms or in monetary terms amounted to several millions of rand. Some cases were successfully prosecuted, but others not. Now, I would be very interested to know whether there is any sharing amongst departments of experience, especially those departments that are excelling in terms of unqualified reports and eliminating many matters of embassies, etc. Chairperson, thank you very much.
Let me start with the sharing by the Department of Information. It is our intention that when we put together the general report, the formal report, we will try to the extent we can, but I think we can get this information to reflect on the good practices that other departments have adopted in order to achieve good results. It is our intention to actually have a chapter on that or some context around that. So we don't necessarily want to paint a picture that is negative only, but we need to also paint a picture that's positive and what drives that positivity. So we will certainly will do that in general, in the formal report as well. But from what I've indicated in my analysis, there are obvious opportunities where departments that have avoided some of the bad results have been doing some of the good practices that I've highlighted as part of the benchmark. Namely, one obvious one, the availability of officials in the audit. That is one practice that we've been struggling on as auditors, and those departments that have taken that seriously in the provinces and the national departments, the results they show immediately. But we'll analyze that in more detail when we put together the general report. As you've noted that. Indeed, that will hopefully emphasize the fact that some of these root cause of the qualification are not necessarily accounting matters, but they are discipline operational issues, which if they can be corrected, they will then have a positive impact on the financial results. There may be one or two that are finance specific, but even the skills one, I would say, is an operational issue, because it will have a positive impact on the accounting results. But we'll endeavor to unpack that in that manner. The oversight over the legislature, certainly these results do show the results of the legislature, but in terms of who's going to then have oversight over those, I do consider that it's something that needs to be considered. But the information is available. In the annual report, information is part of the analysis. The only thing that I may just highlight, which I omitted to mention earlier, is that these statistics exclude information on the secret service account. And we've never in the past included those results in the analysis of the general report. And perhaps we may, with the Senate Committee on Secret Services, agree on how that information should be incorporated in this kind of analysis. But all the secret services are not part of these numbers. But legislatures are part of these numbers. Yeah. The issue around the ability of the national sphere to have effective oversight over the other layer, that is the provincial layer, where service delivery is happening. I think a clear demonstration of how important it is to look into the coordination of oversight. We had a good example test case this year, where when the hearing on health took place, all the HODs of health actually converged in one room so that a holistic picture around the use of the conditional grant could actually be considered. So something similar to that, or even better than that, could actually be considered to make sure that both national and provincial oversight is actually effective. The only omission there, obviously, is that the representatives of the provincial public accounts committee were not part of that debate. And I think these are the issues we need to be looking at as part of looking at how effectively that oversight can be considered. So it is a valid point that does need to be considered here. Because that will then also link to the messages in the annual report and also messages in the audit report. When the hearing is actually held, how do we correlate those messages to make sure that there's no conflict? What we do on the audit side before the annual report are tabled, if we go through those annual reports as part of our audit practice and confirm that there's nothing in the annual report that conflicts the conclusions made on the audit side. So that check we assist you. Then I think it then remains with the oversight to then confirm that the issues that are worthy of probing on the annual report can be probed without any risk of contradiction. But if there are contradictions, we point those out in our report. Hopefully that will assist. But certainly on how that the organization of the linking of the annual report and the audit report information is something that is critical. And I think this operational focus on the root causes can actually create that link to make sure that the annual report undertaking incorporates the operational and financial priorities that need to be considered. We certainly will make provision of the electronic version. Our parliamentary unit will actually make arrangements for that, of this presentation. The question of the benchmarking. We have actually looked carefully at who we should be benchmarking with. And in terms of our understanding of the development of the accounting disciplines in various jurisdictions. And I'm going to start with accounting. There are some, but very few, jurisdictions that are adopting accrual accounting as their method of accounting. But we used to sit in the standard setting body that looks into the accounting, public sector accounting standards. And the setting of those accounting, public sector accounting, the composition of that body is made of developing countries and developed countries representing all continents. But when we actually ask a critical question of whether the countries that are also participating in the setting of the very same standards are adopting them in their jurisdictions, we find that very few actually do that. So the government accounting, basically in most countries, is still in the same manner as it used to be in the olden days, and it's basically in, I would say it's primarily cash accounting. Primarily. And few countries are adopting accrual accounting. Hence, our bias was more towards those countries that have adopted accrual accounting and have actually gone through the transition and have, as a result, learned some lessons through that transition, which I believe we can also learn. We are doing further analysis of this, and we can make that information definitely available on those lessons because they can help us in the journey as well. As we move along. Certainly, if we do pick up countries that are in this process, we are planning to incorporate them as well. But the extraction of the benchmark information is very, very difficult. I mean, we've been trying that with the accountant general, and he's also struggling to get benchmarks for this actual accounting migration. But we're not going to give up on that. We will continue to do that because we can only benefit us. The executive involvement of this, we have made it a point that before we address the legislature, to the extent possible, where the executive was available, we first give this presentation to the executive, particularly the senior. We've made a similar presentation with the DAG to the cabinet about 3 weeks ago, and emphasize the issue that we are emphasizing here. So the sequence of events is executive first and then the legislature. But to the extent it is impossible, where it is not impossible, we are actually doing that after the event.
Yeah, there are one question that was related to was oversight by the legislature itself. And correctly, Honorable Barbara, you raised an issue that in the Constitution, Parliament is given a mandate to oversee everybody. But then the very same Constitution doesn't say how we ourselves, who is overseeing us as a legislature. And I think that's the nature of the debate in which it's now beginning to emerge. I know that when Parliament had to appear before SCOPA, there was a huge debate whether Parliament should or shouldn't. And then one argument was saying, but SCOPA is the creation of Parliament, why do you have to go to our own creation? Now the issue is who then should oversee us? Is it not a body of Parliament, or should it be an external body? And those are one question. But secondly, what is it called, parliamentary oversight authority. At one point it was brought into say that could be the body, but the composition and the nature and its mandate in terms of references, I don't think it is an idea. And then there's this legislation which has been there for almost past 4 years, which Parliament has not yet passed, is it? The financial management of Parliament and provincial legislatures, FABLA. The issue is, we need then also to then process that law. I know Mr. Santanene, you are one of the drivers of that legislation. We need to be M. Kalan. Well, Kalan is... We need to then see that legislation coming to fruition. And then probably in the legislation, then we can then develop mechanisms for overseeing legislatures and Parliament itself in terms of, so that it will not just the figures from the Auditor General, but what happens, what are the mechanisms, the system of auditing, whether we have all those issues in place. And I think that debate has to go. In the oversight module, we are just saying, we need to finally take a conclusion on the matter. It's necessary. We need to have it. And going forward, obviously, then Parliament and legislatures and through whatever mechanisms of engagement, the presiding officer forum and the parliamentary oversight authority, the joint rules committee itself, the issue should be flagged and say we need finality on the issues. And I think those are the forums that we can then utilize and ensure therefore that we do. I belong to those who say we really need to have a mechanism. I belong to that group that wants those particular mechanism to oversee legislation and Parliament. Then the other point that I just wanted to flag on and in response to the Auditor General is the issue of the issues that you were discipline around the issues, the monitoring of the compliance and the role of leadership as far as the oversight is concerned. I will fully agree with you there for that. Part of this exercise really needs to incorporate developing those capacities within the legislature to indeed through the committees and for them to be able to follow up. But the main challenge will be coordination of what happens with the after event, which is what SCOPA does, and what happens throughout the processes of asking the relevant questions without going deeper into the issues as you suggested. That people, we have audit committees in place, I mean that is question which is relevant. to have internal auditing mechanisms that are indeed, you know, aligned to whatever disciplines that are introduced by Treasury and the Auditor General. So I think those type of questions, the committee section or research units could then begin to develop the relevant type of a question here that will then guide as a standardized type, but then committees adopting it flexibly within their own operations of oversight. So that indeed, you know, those type of questions keep being asked and then followed up by the committees themselves when they do their oversight, either in terms of issuing accountability or overseeing that indeed, you know, mandates are carried out within a particular discipline. Yeah, I think that's my response. That let's continue to engage on the issue and this constitution before the term of this parliament. 2009 is around the corner. We need to be ready for the next parliament. Thank you.
I do not get to do that debate really. What was the order? The order was this way. So yourself followed by Mem Kasinyana and Joanne Fabs, Dennis Bloom, Mr. Godi, and yourself. In that order. Yeah.
Thank you, Chairperson. To engage the chair further, I want to talk about the oversight. The public representatives or the members of parliament do oversight, which I think, amongst other things, would also be a source of storing the bad reports which the Auditor General gets. Now, but these MPs sometimes are confronted with challenges where if you get to a department, the official will say, we cannot give you this because you have no mandate to get this. You can't get this. Says, can you give me the program of your department? Says, no, you can't get it. You are not working here. You have you. So what is it perhaps that one can produce to show that we've got a mandate to do the oversight? My second and last question. On your slide, second slide on page 2, you did make mention of the problems with the departments, with their capital assets, the managing of capital assets, with the exception of Gauteng. Now, why do the other provinces have this problem? And why can't we perhaps use Gauteng to assist these provinces so that they can be elevated to the status of Gauteng? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. In that order.
Yeah, Chairperson, mine is just a clarity on the some of the content. More explanation on emphasis of matter. We usually ignore this issue, and maybe every year this appears, even if the department would say there are corrective measures in place to take note of what the Auditor General commented. But I really want to know clarification on that. You said under other matters, most of the departments are affected by that. But if you can just clarify the issue of emphasis of matter, how effective that can be to the report of the department.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thanks to the Auditor General for the presentation. Just 3 points here for you, Chairperson. The one was the statement made by the Auditor General during the presentation. He made the comment that more recently the process has shifted in terms of the introduction of a modified cash accounting system, and therefore all material loss which should be disclosed and all income, etc. In other words, there's been a slight shift in the focus of the auditing itself in this regard. And the question then is, when the shift was done, were the departments communicated with the relevant people, given some understanding as to the reason for the shift and what would be the requirements and how best they would comply with the shift itself? Related to that is another point on page 4 on benchmarking, where it talks about the sustainability of good practices, and then it points out that the availability of key officials during audits. Now, my question would be, in the experience of the Auditor General and his team, has he found that the non-availability of key officials during the audit has seriously negatively impacted on the consequential auditing of that particular department or unit? The last point just in this area, Chairperson, is, although it wasn't really commented on, we hear about reference to other materials and other related matters and so on, and qualified and unqualified. But very often, when one goes back in the tracking, and you track back from a department that now gets a qualified audit or a disclaimer, that the problem germinated much earlier, 5 years earlier, in the lack of practices. What the Auditor General himself referred to is many of the issues are more operational than accounting issues. Documents not being found, this kind of thing. And this is often the case when you track down the problematic department. So why isn't more serious action then taken to prevent more serious problems arising?
Thanks very much, Honorable Bloom.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me also say thank you very much to the AG. It helps a lot to have this type of information. I don't like to ask technical questions. I like to ask operational questions when it comes to this type of things. I want to hear from the AG, in his view, when a department is getting four or five times and qualified audit report, what can the reason be for that? Because, you see, when they are appearing before the relevant portfolio or the committees in Parliament, either SCOPA or the Portfolio Committee, they will always say, year after year, that there's plans in place to address those issues. But next year they will come back and say, no, there's plans in place. We are going to address that. What do you think is the problem for that type of issue each year, 5 or 6 years in a row?
Thank you, Honorable Bloom. Honorable Goji.
Thank you, Chairperson. AG, when one looks at the first page in terms of the audit opinions, comparing 2005, 2006, as well as this one, it looks more or less like a cut and paste. Can you contextualize this lack of movement or improvement in the sense that is it just a static situation, or is it maybe impeded upon by added requirements of disclosure that the raising of the bar that then keeps departments where they were before? Secondly, it's around, yes, the qualifications, that it's more the challenge of operational issues than accounting issues. To what extent are these impacted upon by either the vacancy rates in departments or the lack of appropriate skills in the department. Thank you.
The three questions, I know that the honorable member and Eddie Trent would follow. Can I start with before Eddie Trent?
Yes. Chief, first of all, I would also like to thank the AG for this new way of doing things. I think it's very good that this meeting is done publicly and open. And also the emphasis on the purpose is to try and get less qualified reports and to improve the administrative practice. But it gives a statistical report in many respects. It gives us statistics, and I just have two questions on that aspect and one less important. The Auditor General said, and to me this is very serious, he said, I mean, he said in the graph, 27 to 30%, that's provincial and national, cannot provide supportive evidence to expenditure. It's just as an example. Now, you know, that sounds bad, but what I'd like to ask you, Auditor General, can you also quantify that? Because if those departments that fall in the category of not providing evidence are the big spenders, then clearly that the picture is going to look different. It's going to look far more serious. So that's my first question. Can that evidence be provided and quantified, not just in terms of how many departments? Because a small department wouldn't make material difference in the big picture. That's the first question. The second question is, and this also impacts on the statistics. The AG said when he was talking about the audits, he said the following, that, and if I'm correct, if I'm wrong, you must correct me, that 50% of the audits were allowed to make material adjustments during the audit. Alright? Now, the consequence of that is that a department or entity that may have got a qualified audit didn't get one because they were allowed to make a material changes to the audit. Now, I'm not saying that that's bad, but it does create a rather more comfortable situation than maybe that we actually are facing in reality in terms of the ability of departments to, you know, to present their accounts in an acceptable format. So if we could just how would that have impacted on the report had you not allowed that? And then just lastly, if it's possible, you said that in terms of the non-compliance with legislation, it was mostly PFMA, and that makes sense, it's an audit. But to what extent are other non-compliance issues impacting on delivery? In other words, can you give us some percentages vis-a-vis PFMA and other legislation which clearly relates more to the mandate of that department and its function in terms of service delivery to the public? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. My question is just adding on other questions that have been asked already, and that comes down to the human factor. Because it has been indicated also at the root causes that compliance is a problem, readiness and skills is a problem. And we know that one can have the best plans from year to year, but if the skills are not there, you know, you can do nothing. So competency and skills, and then also what I've picked up in the audit, in the report that has, was submitted to our committee, is the vacancy rate that has been used in many, many, many examples as a reason for underperformance. To what extent is that a critical situation and a factor in this the whole audit and your report? And surely there must be a submission or a proposal in that regard of how to move forward. Otherwise, we're going to be static. Thank you, sir.
Then hand over to the AG to then respond to the questions.
Yes, indeed. The issue of human resource management factor is critical. That, and that's why we actually had this area covered in the focus area in our audit. And what this does, and I guess to get the details, one has got to go through the actual reports of the department. And what it simply did here was say, these are the areas we should focus on, and these are the areas where when we read the reports, perhaps we should actually pay attention. But generally, what we're picking up in this human resource management review is a situation where we pick up the issue of the vacancy levels in the department. We pick up the issue of the skills levels in the department. And that's where the compliance with the HR plan is concerned. But in other instances, this will pick up the situation where the HR plan itself or strategy is not even in the final form, it's in draft form. It's obvious we then have the effect of saying even the situation of addressing the human resource challenge has not been formalized in the department. These are some of the issues that have been highlighted. And obviously there's different actions for those different undertakings that or situations that we pick up during the audit. So I think when we then get the reports, or when the reports are considered from a oversight perspective, one has got to look into the reasons that are underpinning this. So that's why I think the details dealing within those broad categories are important to understand and important to say what action should be taken, because if the plan is not approved, then the action is going to be different. If the plan is approved but not achieved, the next question obviously to the legislature is what support do you need? What guidance do you need? Or what resources do you need? So it's a different set of questions for different results. But certainly if the department hasn't even approved its plan, then it's a different set of questions. So those are the two categories that we picked up in so far as this is concerned. And I think that will also touch on the question that was raised by Mr. Goody as well, to a large extent. And with regard to the legislative compliance, and splitting that between the pure financial management compliance and other legislation that is leaning more towards the mandate of the department, the bulk of these relate to the financial management compliance issues. There are few instances where, like for instance, in the Division of Revenue Act, where the issue may relate to the actual mandate of the province to actually implement that specific legislation to effect conditional grant. And in a few instances where there may be compliance to environmental laws in the case of health, where we're looking at, for instance, management of waste material and so on and so forth. But the majority relates to the finance management. Okay. We can provide a statement as soon as possible. We'll see if we can do that when we put together the final report. But the bulk is on financial management and treasury regulation. These material changes, and I think the point that you made here is very important. Because this is in the nature of the audit that when adjustments are made, you cannot actually deem the accounts to be incorrect when the facts have been corrected. So when corrections are made, you cannot qualify the account. But what we do is to understand what were the reasons for the last minute adjustment, and then point those out. Hence the prevalence of about 50% of the departments that have had to do that, and we often say the control environment needs to be attended to. The skills issue may need to be attended to. But the support from the treasurers may need to be attended to. So that does not happen repeatedly from time to time. So that's the context we've actually put behind these material changes. And that is why we have decided if departments do make adjustments, we don't leave that in the management report, but we bring it to the same issue of material to the face of the report. And if you read those reports, you realize that it's millions, multiple millions that have been adjusted in the last hour. It's not tiny amounts. So those reports make interesting reading where we're talking about material adjustments. The evidence linking to expenditure, this definitely applies mainly to his department. And these apply mainly to those departments that have been had disclaimers. And if you read those reports, well, you may not have access to the provincial reports, but if you look at the reports of all the departments that have been disclaimed, the two in the Southern Cape, one in the Guadalcanal, the four in the Eastern Cape that have been hardly disclaimed, talking big departments. Except my kind of culture, but for these other two, I mean, it's health, education, and social services, those huge departments. And you're talking big spending, you're not talking small money. So, but all that will be reflected also in the general report.
With regards to the, I think, Mr. Godi, if you're happy with the issue of the vacancy,
I was saying that if Mr. Godi is happy with the comment on the vacancies, it basically stems from our review of the human resource management practices. That's where most of the root of that is. And that's why when the question is asked, we need to say to ourselves what is driving this. But if there are vacancies, certainly in the financial side, we need to deal with that. And the bulk of these observations are driven by skill issue, support from treasury, and the vacancies in the financial sector, the financial administration of the department. And it's something that does need to be addressed. And I wouldn't exclude the legislative role in actually asking those questions and providing whatever support is needed to deal with the matter. A more difficult question is the repetitive qualifications and the reference to plans to offer a system. I think my response, and I hope it's not going to sound very simplistic, when plans are set in place, we need to ask what plans so that we know the details of the plans. And if it's plans relating to financial administration, this is where we need to get into the depth of what plans are talking about. Are the plans to sort out what? Is it a skills issue or is it a control environment issue? So that we know exactly what plans are being put in place. And I guess this comes back to the question of how do you then provide sufficient support to the legislature to ask the right questions so that things don't get carried over without specifics in terms of what actions we take. I don't know whether that doesn't sound too simplistic or not.
Thank you very much. No, that's okay. We'll invite you to my comment. Come and give us the details there and thanks.
Yes, indeed, the shift in accounting focus. That's a correct analysis. That has been the main reason for these qualifications. Change management around that. National Treasury, I think, has done a lot in the form of training the CFOs. They even have a CFO forum that is in place to actually provide guidance to the CFOs. But I guess Treasury can also do that much. If there's no reciprocal input from the department to provide CFOs that are qualified enough to do their job, then I guess Treasury can do limited amount of support in change management. But the other issue that is critical here for the change management is the need to strengthen the provincial treasury. So that national treasury does not necessarily have to be doing this work single-handedly, but they need to work collaboratively with the provincial treasury. And in most instances, we do find that the coordination between national treasury and provincial treasury does require to be improved. And I think we need to be working on those improvements. We also are having a quarterly session with national treasury to address exactly this issue so that we identify areas that require attention in the department and make sure that treasury is set there in their support of the department ongoing. So that's what we're trying to do on our side. K
key officials available during the audit and impact on the audit process, one cannot emphasize this hard enough. And as I've said, where officials have had a change of heart and made themselves available, especially HODs or county officers, the difference was very visible. Departments have been able to move from a disclaimer to an unqualified report just in 1 year. And we've got examples of that. By doing nothing but just get to get the HOD to be available. So it does pay off at the end of the day, and it does have an impact. What we do on our side is to coordinate this through the hearing committees that we encourage to be held at least every week, or at least once every 2 weeks, so that it's a structured session that needs to be held, and all that needs to be done is for people to be available. We also make every attempt to get our senior managers participate in this forum, because if you're going to expect the HODs to be part of the forum, then our senior managers need to be part of this forum. Certainly, if I'm going to digress a little bit to local government, where we're covering long distances, especially in big provinces, even a telephonic contact would have to be tricky, so that at least there's ongoing communication and ongoing feedback. Where I think we've got a challenge to implement this even much more stricter is in the case where we actually contract work out to the audit firm. We need to make sure that these do happen and that we've got a representative from the office, if not from the office, but the partner in charge actually maintains this kind of system. So we need a much more closer monitoring on our side and so far as the contract work is concerned, so that there is a commitment on both sides of the audit process. Yes, the source of the qualifications, you're right, they start small and they escalate into big things. Hence, in the audit process, we have the management reports, which don't get reflected in the audit report. And if departments then attend to the management report issues, to a large extent, they avoid issues escalating into qualifications. But also, to take that a step further, other issues may not be qualifications, but they may be raised as other matters. Those other matters need to be taken seriously because they are serious. Because if they're not taken seriously, they may escalate to a situation where they become qualifications. So, yeah, I think you're absolutely right to say they germinate from early beginnings into bigger issues. And the monitoring that you talk about. Monitoring happens by leadership. We can be able to actually put a link to these practices. Indeed, the use of emphasis versus other matters is something that we have looked into in our reporting. And what we used to call emphasis of matter in the past has now changed to other matters, so that we reduce emphasis to something less confusing. So the only thing that we now highlighted as emphasis of matter is a matter that we need to draw to the attention of the reader or the legislature in the financial system. Namely, for example, if there's an amount that we need to take account of, let's say, for instance, irregular expenditure, if it's of that magnitude, because we don't report on that, but the departments have got, in terms of the treasury reporting requirements, have a responsibility to disclose that. Now, if that amount is of that magnitude, we'll actually point that amount to the attention of the legislature of the user. So any other amount that we believe from our own judgment is worthy of attending to, or any issue that is worthy of attending to, even if it's sitting in the annual report, will actually draw the attention of the reader to that matter. We may be missing some of the things that you may consider important, but that's the best we try to do to guide the reader of the financial statement. So the emphasis is limited to only those issues now, not concerns, but issues that he is aware of. And the issue of access to information by the oversight is a tricky one, because I don't know the practices that govern the legislature to having access to information in the department. But that as it may be, I would imagine that the response to a question at least should be respected. Even though access to information may be an issue, but simple questions may actually yield an automatic disclosure of information anyway. That will depend how the question is posed. because here I guess we need to just be mindful of not intruding into the administrative or executive responsibilities, because there's a fine line between oversight and administration. And maybe it's in those instances where we want to overrun the department, but the department push back. But I don't know the circumstances, because I don't know the nature of the question that was asked. Yeah. And therefore that would lead us to actually outline exactly what the role of oversight is and what are the parameters within which we need to confine our role. Yes, the last issue on the assets. The root of the assets is that it's a matter that is of high magnitude in departments, because here we're dealing, bear in mind, with a situation where over years government money was spent to buy assets. But there was never a requirement to actually record those assets officially because of the cash accounting model. Now, the requirement now is to say all those assets that are bought over many years, we should actually identify them and bring them into our books. Now, the process of getting there, when the discipline was never there to record them, what is giving a challenge to the department? And hence, the coordinated approach to actually deal with this issue. In reading, for instance, the book on the transition from cash to accrual accounting, that was commissioned by the International Public Sector Accounting Standards Committee. The accounting for assets, even for those countries that have now stabilized on accrual accounting, was the most difficult aspect to deal with. And therefore, this is not unique to us in South Africa only. And in that book, which I think Treasury has got, there are lessons there that are clearly defined in terms of how to approach this particular challenge. And perhaps we need to, in addition to what Gauteng is doing, what other departments, because not only Gauteng, there are departments within the provinces that have actually mastered this. There are departments within the national departments that have mastered this. So that knowledge sharing, I think, does need to be elevated and superimpose other lessons from other countries as well. But learning is all within us. But I would say that the biggest learning is commitment. But those departments that have really put a commitment to this have actually got it right. I mean, Mpumalanga, for instance, the department wrote there was the most complicated assets to account for, but because the HOD took that seriously, I mean, they did not have a qualification on that matter. And to identify a role department assets is not an easy task, but they got it right. Thank you, sir.
Thanks very much. For now, members, I think this really brings us to the end of the session. And I'm quite confident in my mind. So, you know, I'm closing the meeting. Must look on the program. We said there will be substantive discussions and engagements. There's going to be a meeting of the Standing Committee on Public Accounts. Those members who may want to join, they can join. Maybe they can engage first. But for now, really, our business is open. But I have to say, I think in my view, Chairperson, the meeting was helpful in many respects. On the one hand, it was a mirror, you know, where to position us as public representatives in terms of power that nobody has but ourselves. Whether we have used that power to do the right things, you know. All kinds of issues that have been raised, for instance, by Honorable Barbara Hogan, it's a policy issue, fundamental policy issue, which resides with us. It's a policy choice. How should legislatures account? It's a policy choice. I don't think anybody can answer that question. Anybody can formulate a policy except ourselves. You know? AG cannot answer that. I don't think, in terms of separation of power, even the president cannot answer that. But it's about ourselves. We may have attempted to answer the question, but in answering that question, there may be more questions. Now, that I have you from the answer, and then the answer is only attempting to respond to the question. No? So that's how I look at it. But more importantly, I think quite a number of strategic issues that we need to look at in terms of positioning ourselves, dealing with all the issues that have been raised by the AG. Are issues of coordination. Coordination between the National Assembly Portfolio Committee and the select committees of the NCOP, you know, given the distinct constitutional mandate that this particular two houses, you know, are vested with. Example, the grand advocate Matita Ebrahim. He says, I'm overseeing a department which highlights deals with policy at national level. There's less that we can talk about in terms of the audit report. Because bulk of finances and spending that arises from social development is not implemented, you know, in Pretoria or at national level, but it's implemented at provincial level. So how do we bring some coordination in terms of ensuring that we achieve this vision? I think your vision is a shared vision for all of us. MPs are here because they also want to ensure that there's a, you know, how do you put it, unqualified support. I think we're here for that. So I think those are some of the challenges really that have arisen in a more sharper focus. And as we go back to our different committees on our group, we'll actually be beginning to say, what is it that we have been doing? What continue to be the weaknesses? And arising from this presentation and overall challenges, how do we begin to do things in a better way? How do we, what are the challenges? Because challenges can be there, but what is the nature of the challenge? It's a challenge because procedures are dealing with a particular issue is inadequate, that also resides with us. Is the challenge there because we don't have sufficient capacity to do those things? I think those are some of the questions, you know, honorable members, that we have to deal with, you know, outside the scope of this meeting. And I'm quite confident that this would have helped us really to use the issue of the Auditor General's report in a more robust way, you know, as an effective tool and instrument for oversight, you know, for a better life for all. All of us, you know, together, you know, with our shared and separate responsibility, we'll actually achieve that thing. But that does not only meet the, you know, requirement and some, no, declarations, but it requires planning. Planning is quite fundamental, isn't it? Some of the things that we have not been dealing with, I think they have been answered. What type of questions are we asking? Honorable Bloom, we're in one meeting of one committee this week. The issue we're raising, the serious example. 2005, you get a report from the department, they've got vacancy rate. Ne? 2006, they bring again vacancy rate. Ne? We don't ask, is this vacancy rate the same one that you addressed? Because last year you said, you're having a plan. You even then realize that we did not even ask them, what plan are they having in place to address this thing? Are there time frames, you know, attached to that? So I'm saying this really was providing a scope for introspection, was providing a scope for us to build much better capacity to deal with these challenges. So on that note, I really want to thank you and your team for having afforded us this opportunity to exchange on this critical side of our struggle to create a better life for all. Because without money, without proper governance of our resources as a country, all the dreams that we have of a better life for all and everything that we're talking about will simply remain a pipe. So this is one of the most critical instruments that as an institution elected by our people, we should be seized with, you know, and give, you know, the attention that it deserves. So thank you on that note. Over to you, Honorable.
I'll deal just with announcements. One is that all of you are invited, members and all staff and officials present here, at 12:30 to join the AG and his team for a lunch in the old assembly restaurant. So if all of you could please assemble there, they've really made an effort of providing. And I think those who are available, not rushing for planes and so forth, make it a point too that you are available at half past 12 or the assembly restaurant. They are paying. You don't have to pay this time around. And then the SCOPA will be remaining behind just for some internal processing of the issues to the AG and the team. So for almost about 45 minutes or so that then indeed, we release the AG to join us for lunch, as we'll be joining him for lunch. So please, he's our host in the lunch. So whatever are the issues, unfortunately, we no longer have 1.5 hours with him. But I hope you'll be able to process those issues that you want to process as COPPA. And then they also informed that the DVD of this meeting will be made available per request. it has been made, the meeting was recorded live, but also a report will then be developed, you know, both on the presentation, on the submissions of the presentation itself, the questions and answers that you were able to ask and there were responses. So that some of the chairs who had given apologies, who are not here, would also be able then to benefit from the discussion. Some obviously had indicated they will arrive late. And indeed, you know, I see Tandy just arrived in Abutovia. But then there are those who said they will arrive late, they couldn't make it to us because they had other engagement and other meetings. So that all of us could then and benefit then, and it will be also be available to parties, the report, not only to the committees in both houses. But also then to say that when SOPA engages on these issues, usually they do invite when some of the sessions involve a particular committee, the chair will be invited. It has been a choice of the chair to attend or not, and I said to the chair, Mr. Godi, that you need to be an obligatory attendance on the side of the chair because there are quite important issues when we deal with that particular portfolio issues that arises in the Auditor General, that the chair could be there or the chair with whoever that would be assigned to attend so that they can then follow up on the corrective measures that usually SCOPA enters into with the department. And then we find that no one monitors those particular corrective measures and continuously they are raised or they follow, they keep coming up in subsequent reports thereafter. If it could be an obligation on the side of the church really to, because not every time that you are inviting the church, only when you deal with the issue relating to that particular portfolio. So if you could really make it as one of the strong recommendations that an obligatory commitment by a chair or somebody assigned by that particular committee to attend when you deal with a specific department on whatever issues that, so that the committee can then make a follow-up.
Chair, sorry, not that I want mine to be the last word, I want yours to be the last word, but that's on the issue of the DVD. Could we request that everybody that was a participant in this meeting be provided with one, rather than it being requested by participants as a condition for it being provided?
Yeah, the capacity to give to everyone. So the report will be presented to everybody. But the DVD, obviously, something else.
Jim, I make a suggestion, as is the custom with our hearing discussion, that we should just have a transcription done of these proceedings and then lay on record for everybody to read and take note of.
The point of order, Chair.
Chair, I don't understand what you are discussing.
Chair, please close the meeting. You are going backwards and forwards now. You have already, that's your summary of the meeting.
Yeah.
Don't entertain any other thing. People,
honorable members, usually don't discuss announcements. A DVD will be made available. The AG is preparing that. We'll then make sure that everyone present will get it. A report is also going to be developed and circulated to everybody, those present and those who are not present. They'll all get the transcript of the report of the meeting. And then you're all invited for that. I don't understand what is the whole discussion. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.
Time. I'm thankful that you're able to make for this time to be with us. We were quite aware that in your interactions, the interactions that you've had in the various provinces, you have not had to have this additional session. It is after your presentation. Maybe three things. One, this your format is a new one, so we're not sure how in practice it is going to pan out. And we became apprehensive and became ambitious at the same time. Apprehensive in the sense that we did not want this meeting that has just ended to steal our thunder as COPA. And we became a bit ambitious in thinking that we could have this session and immediately thereafter have our SCOPA session so as to kill four birds with two stones.
to see that there was no need, there was no basis for apprehension, and that we might not have been able to cure for basis two stones. In the sense that once again, like you did during the April conference, looking at your presentation, it is able to make sense to all of us from Parliament without necessarily reducing our traditional processes to merely going through the motions. And I do see that a few of our members, in terms of the report I got, all the agents caught up with them. And the symptoms of old age, sickness, has rendered them unavailable to Parliament. And the key question that I must also throw to my members who are here, who have actually sacrificed and soldiered on, I know Kigiza, I know Honorable Trent, should actually have not even been here, but as a loyal cadre of this committee, they have stayed on. It's to say, to what extent would it be prudent for us to go into the very substantive issues that are the hallmark of our engagement in terms of our ability to effectively engage with those issues? And to what extent would it represent the fulfillment of the customary processes? Leaving outside those of our members who are not here in a manner that would actually be able to effectively serve the people that it must serve. I think it is an issue that I would want to raise with the committee members, but also to check with you as well. I do know that our program that we have agreed upon this week has hearings right up to the 21st of November. And the last day here in Parliament is the 23rd of November. So it might as well be that we may need to agree how we handle this process going forward. I would want to first hear from you. I know it's an ambush. I hope it's not an effective one. You can still maneuver out of it. And then you also check with the members. Yeah.
Now, thank you very much, Chair, for the feedback. I do concur with you that the purpose of this session was merely to raise awareness of the issues that will facilitate coordination by all committees of Parliament. And if we have we could have achieved that purpose, then I think we all join, which will indeed strengthen the work that the Public Accounts Committee scope specifically in this regard nationally has got to deal with. So I think based on that, I do agree that there is a way forward, and that way forward is clear in my mind. We haven't dealt here with details that are contained in the report. If you read those reports, you've got serious issues there that need attention. Particularly stuff that is raised under other matters. It's not stuff that should be set aside. It's stuff for which questions and support and guidance need to be provided on how those things are going to be eliminated, so that they don't build up to areas and situations rather that will end up being qualifications. So I think while the matters may have escaped the qualification this year, we need to make sure that we don't enter into similar situations come next year. And it has just been in the analysis. The issues are pretty simple from the accounting point of view. But the underlying resources and structures and environment that needs to be fixed to make sure that we've got sustainable financial administration. So on that basis, I do think that the root causes, even though they may sound repetitive, they are very, very pointed, to use the term chair, to actually say what are the issues at hand. And the issues at hand are these issues that we've highlighted in this report. But they will have different flavors, different departments. But the other choices are more or less similar. And I do trust that then going forward into these hearings, we're not going to necessarily focus on the superficial findings that we've actually identified. But we're going to focus on the root of these issues so that then the action that's been taken can be the action that is going to bring about quick wins towards the unqualified report. So we've tried by all means to suppress the symptoms but to highlight the root causes. But then to the extent that we have not done that sufficiently, we need to work on that between ourselves as a group in identifying these issues. The head of audit definitely are meant to be regular participants in these hearings so that if myself and the DG are not available for all the hearings, at least the people that sign the report, that coordinated the signing of the report, can at least provide the right context, both from the point of view of the preparation and from the point of view of the hearing itself. I don't know, I haven't seen the calendar, but I do trust that the calendar does suit our diaries. But we'll do every maneuver on our side to actually make ourselves available. But it's not the head of the head of court. The planning though, Chair, we haven't had an opportunity since your strategic session to actually engage to say how do we then take lessons of last year and the opportunities that we need to exploit the talent for going forward, how do we manage them so effectively. So it may be necessary to have, even if it's one half day session, to reflect on the results of your strategic session. So then that will focus our minds as an audit team, dividing our responsibilities and allocating our responsibilities and down. So that thing will be input again. I can touch on with regard to your operations.
All right, engage. I thought you would also focus on the now situation. I said I would seek guidance from you, but also from the members of the committee. Because what we had envisaged earlier on was to have a full-blown engagement on the substantive issues in the general report. But I'm asking the wisdom and whether it is prudent right now for us to go that route.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, can I have a response?
I don't know perhaps if I've got the context of your question, but I'd like to say, let us continue according to our program, not specifically zeroing in on this particular outcomes report. Perhaps we might have a look at that next year. But what I wanted to add on was perhaps wouldn't it assist us with our regards to A, B categories of the report when we do the resolutions, we also direct them pointedly, specifically, to the relevant portfolio committee chair, so that those issues that we have recommended, they are monitored throughout the year, perhaps, so that we don't get a repeat the site of the same the following year. Thank you, Chair.
I think I've got a slight view of the attendance. I think what the Auditor General is bringing to us is very critical for all of us as members of the COPA to be aware, because that's the way we are going to be moving forward. I would suggest not to go to school for whatever, but we agree on the postponement of this engagement, which I feel is very, very important. And then we will get the date from the Auditor General when the Auditor General, and we also have to sacrifice. When the Auditor General says it will be on Thursday, we must find a way of making ourselves available for the next day or whatever day it is. Thank you.
Genius, I'm going to say this, and I'm not saying it for the press because they're not here, but I am actually appalled at the attendance of my colleagues at this meeting. I think it is, I won't be going too far, but I think it is really, it's not very respectful towards the Office of the Auditor General. He comes down here with a senior staff to get his briefing, and most of our members are not here. But I just want to concur with my colleagues. It's not acceptable. However, having said that, I can see no purpose just to continue interrogating this now, because that's the one reason, because there's only a third of us here. Secondly, I'm sure the actual report will be coming fairly soon, which will have the detail in it, and that will give us a better idea, a better basis on which to interrogate these matters. And then thirdly, Chair, on your recommendation, we are going to be calling all the departments this year, so that also gives us a wider interaction with government generally. So on the basis of those, for those three reasons, I don't believe we can serve any purpose by continuing with this interrogation. Interaction right now.
TG, if I may check with you, is it is it likely that the report will be out before we go into recess? Or going on recess on the 23rd of November?
Planning, because information is readily available. It's now a question now having gone around to all the legislatures to put together the report that will reflect most of the input we got from these sessions. And that's why we decided to engage them, so that the context can be reflective of this. Now, it should take us, where are we now, end of October. I think we'll need 3 weeks to actually wrap up the report. 3 weeks would be when? Mid-November. November. I may be overseas, but you can work on this thing, I mean, remotely. I mean, technology is not important. It allows these things to happen. So, by the, if you can tell us the date by when I need it, we can commit to actually have it available by 15th to 20th of November.
You covered. Oh, all right. Yeah, I think it is possible for us to maybe look at using one Tuesday, which of course will be a briefing day. Maybe starting 8 at night, have an hour and a half briefing, and from there, then have this report presented and discussed before we go on recess. I don't think it is impossible. I think it is possible. We have the 13th, which is a Tuesday, and the 20th. I think we can arrange those outside here, and administratively, whether we can have the 13th or the 20th. So that by the time we go on recess, at least we have that report. Except that you'll find that at least 4 or 5 departments will by then have appeared before us. But since we're having about 6 or whatever, 7 departments, whatever they want, 34 departments, I think the overwhelming majority will still be outstanding. So I think the line of thinking was that maybe it will benefit our other colleagues who are not here, because this report is supposed to inform the strategic approach of the entire committee. So if they are not able to interact with this information at the level of this presentation and be able to seek clarity and raise substantive questions, it might actually not empower us as sufficiently as we would like to. Let me thank you again, AG. As I indicated, we're apprehensive, we're ambitious, and it appears that on both scores, we've lost hands down in terms of our calculations. But it was merely to say, how do we ensure that we enhance our work? And it was the first time that even the powers that be in Parliament were to sit over lunch in order to ensure that there is understanding amongst ourselves to try and smooth out the process. Nobody was sure how it's going to pan out. And I do believe that going forward, next year and the subsequent years, these experiences will be carried forward. I'm here a joke. But still love Chinese. Thanks very much, AJ. I think would want to stop right here and say that the administrative room check and agree on the date in terms of when the substantive presentation can be made. I think that will be fine. Thank you very much.